from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The largest protests in recent memory took place across the U.S. this weekend, with rallies in both New York and Washington drawing crowds in the hundreds of thousands protesting racism and police violence. In New York, crowds gathered in various spots around the city, including Washington Square Park.
Whose city?
Our city!
Whose city?
Our city!
In Washington, D.C., some speakers pointed out that the problem has continued despite previous protests.
In the 3.5 years since I've been at Howard University, we heard about Troy Davis. We heard about Trayvon Martin. We heard about Eric Garner. We heard about Michael Brown. We marched, we protested, we chanted, and we got zero guilty verdicts. All that says is the system is working for the people that it was always meant to work for.
Press TV's Colin Campbell was there and filed this report.
For Anthony Gadsden and his sons, this demonstration was as much necessary as it was personal. He remembers an encounter with police over an improper left turn.
If I didn't have, I guess, you know, calm nerves, easily, I could have actually been on the stage talking about the death of my sons or them talking about the death of me.
Cameron Gadsden says he learned a valuable lesson about police that day.
Some, they can turn in a quick second. Like, for instance, on that day, just it didn't feel right.
Protesters have traveled here from all over the country to be here for this march on Washington called the Justice for All rally, led by the Reverend Al Sharpton. Demonstrators are urging for a stronger congressional action and for more police accountability. Families of those affected by police shootings spoke out, including those of Amadou Diallo, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and others. James Hodge says lawmakers need to feel increased pressure.
We're not accepting what's going on, and we want change, and we want justice for these individuals that have been killed.
I think all of us that are out here, you, myself, my sons, the conversation has to continue.
Protesters say they'll increase demands on lawmakers for policing reforms. Sharpton says he's prepared to return for another rally if there's no progress. Colin Campbell, Washington.
Some of those in attendance at the Washington rally complained that the event was being overly orchestrated and tried to force organizers to allow people from Ferguson to address the crowd.
Nick Papa online, president of the Lawyers Committee.
We love our sister Barbara, but what I have here is Ferguson people that want to speak, and we need to let them speak. We need to let them speak. Let them speak.
But the event went on as scheduled without further interruption. Large crowds also took part in rallies in Boston, Chicago, Oakland, and other major U.S. cities, with both the absolute numbers of protesters nationally and the fact that the protests have been sustained and growing for many weeks, raising the question of whether the protests have evolved into a movement. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. In Australia, central Sydney was on lockdown for most of Monday, after an armed man took more than a dozen people hostage at a busy cafe early Monday morning. The suspected gunman, Manharan Monis, was killed during a nighttime rescue operation, along with two of the hostages, a 34-year-old man and a 38-year-old woman, according to local police. Police stormed the building around 2 a.m. local time. Monis, who was identified by Australian media and police as being the gunman behind the 16-hour standoff at the Lindt Chocolate Cafe, apparently died during or shortly after the raid, according to police, along with the two hostages. The cafe is across the street from a major Australian TV station. Earlier, hostages inside the cafe reportedly spoke to local TV stations and identified Monis as their captor. According to local media, Monis demanded to talk to Prime Minister Tony Abbott live on the radio. Before the raid, Abbott released a statement expressing confidence that Australian authorities could handle the situation.
New South Wales police are responding. They are being strongly supported by Commonwealth agencies. I can let you know that the National Security Committee of the Cabinet has been briefed on this incident. I want to assure people that the ordinary business of government must go on, and it will go on, and that's why Treasurer Hockey and Finance Minister Cormann will shortly be releasing the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook as planned.
After the raid, the Prime Minister had this to say.
This is a very disturbing incident. It is profoundly shocking that innocent people should be held hostage by an armed person claiming political motivation. Nevertheless, I can say that New South Wales Police and other agencies have responded to this incident with great professionalism. Throughout the day, there has been nothing but complete and total cooperation between different governments and different agencies. You can be proud of the way your police and security bodies have responded to the events of this day. I think I can also commend the people of Sydney for the calmness with which they have reacted to this disturbing incident. We are a free, open and generous people, and today we have responded to this in character.
All trains were shut down in that part of the city, and police with guns drawn patrolled the area surrounding the cafe. Weekend elections in Japan left Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a big winner after the governing coalition, led by his Liberal Democratic Party, took more than two-thirds of the seats in the lower house of the Diet, the nation's bicameral legislature. We have this from the Japanese news agency, NHK.
The Japanese Prime Minister's political gamble in calling an early election has paid off. Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition won a landslide victory. His Liberal Democratic Party and its partner Kōmeitō have secured a two-thirds majority in the lower house. The parties won 326 of the 475 seats in the chamber. That's well above the 317 needed to secure a two-thirds majority. And it means the ruling parties will be able to set their agenda for the Diet and see it through.
The weekend vote posted a record low turnout, with only about half of voters bothering to cast ballots. Among others seeing big gains was Japan's Communist Party, which won 21 seats, more than double the eight it previously held. It was the first time since the year 2000 that the party was able to secure 10 or more seats. Saturday marked the 10th anniversary of the historic meeting between Fidel Castro and then-Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez that led to the birth of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Peoples of Our America, or ALBA, a political, economic, and social bloc of progressive Latin American countries that has become a model for integration structures around the world. Telesur's Rachel Boothroyd reports from Caracas.
It was at this moment that the two governments signed an agreement allowing for the direct exchange of medical resources and personnel for oil. Since then, the ALBA has gone on to include six other members, including Bolivia and Nicaragua. It focuses on promoting reciprocal exchange between member states, prioritising solidarity mechanisms which favour less developed members, and breaking with the competition which drives free trade agreements.
It's fitting for us to come together and make a collective effort amongst ourselves for us all to advance and benefit from what is being carried out.
As member states celebrate the 10th anniversary of the ALBA, political observers say the regional bloc's importance is still yet to be fully recognised. Arnold August, author of Cuba and its Neighbours, Democracy in Motion, describes the organisation as the building block for other regional integration bodies such as the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Organisations which would have been unthinkable without the willingness of Chavez and Castro to invent as opposed to follow revolutionary blueprints. Rachel Boothroyd for Telesur in Caracas, Venezuela.
Last week's climate conference in Peru left at least one person hopeful that a global agreement might be reached and signed next year. That person, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
Decisions adopted in Lima, Peru at the UN Climate Change Conference pave the way for a universal and meaningful agreement in 2015, according to the UN Secretary General. In a statement issued after the talks concluded on Sunday, Ban Ki-moon welcomed the outcome of the two-week conference, which includes the adoption of the Lima Call for Climate Action. The meeting brought together the 196 parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UN UNFCCC, who are working to reach an agreement by December 2015 at the next climate summit in Paris, France. In Lima, Mr. Ban said the parties made important advances in clarifying their intended contributions, commitments that will help reduce carbon emissions and prevent dangerous human interference with the climate system. Media reports indicated on Sunday that differences over setting national pledges are what caused the conference to overrun by 2 days. The UN chief called on countries, especially those with major economies, to submit what he called their ambitious national commitments well in advance of the next global climate event next year. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
A hearing at Guantanamo Bay looking into FBI infiltration of legal defense teams during detainee hearings has been canceled with no reason given. The 2-day pretrial hearing at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay would have focused on alleged FBI contact with defense teams. Lawyers defending the defendants accused of involvement in the September 11, 2001 airplane attacks on the World Trade Center had asked Judge James Paul to revisit evidence that FBI attorneys had approached a security officer for the defense teams. David Nevin, lead defense counsel for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was one of those facing prosecution at Guantanamo Bay, said in the absence of such review, quote, "We can't dispel the idea we're being watched, which chills the ability to conduct a defense," closed quote. Judge Pohl, who was also a colonel in the U.S. Army, ruled in July that no conflict of interest had arose. However, Reuters reported that the Defense Department website showed, quote, "a flurry of secret filings in recent days, including from a special Justice Department team appointed to investigate the FBI's role," closed quote. The hearing would have been the first to be held since the Senate report on CIA torture was released last week. Meanwhile, the fallout continues after the release last week of that report, which revealed some of the details of the U.S. CIA torture policies under the Bush administration. Although the involvement of both U.S. intelligence and military officials in torture and other illegal acts has been known for many years, including the training in torture techniques, political assassinations, and other illegal acts at the former School of the Americas, the level of detail given in the cases included in last week's report sparked international outrage that's still burning worldwide. We begin with this report from RT's Marina Portnaya.
The world's most powerful nation finally admitting to a gruesome and brutal truth.
In contrast to CIA representations, detainees were subjected to the most aggressive techniques immediately, stripped naked, diapered, physically struck, and put in various painful stress positions for long periods of time.
The shocking details surrounding the CIA's interrogation and detention program were revealed in a 525-page report unveiled by the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Releasing this report is an important step to restore our values and show the world that we are, in fact, a just and lawful society.
Human rights groups and the United Nations have renewed calls for accountability, but U.S. President Barack Obama, who banned torture upon entering office, says the country should look forward, not back.
I think it's important for us not to paint a broad brush about all the incredible, dedicated professionals in our intelligence community.
By not holding anyone accountable, critics say the U.S. leader is creating a dangerous state of affairs.
By choosing to move on, to forget about the past, not to prosecute the serious crime, Obama is keeping torture as a misguided, wrongful policy option for some future American president.
Meanwhile, the current CIA director is defending his agency, saying it did a lot of things right post 9/11. He's just not sure if that includes the use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques.
We have not concluded that it was the use of EITs within that program that allowed us to obtain useful information from detainees subjected to them.
The CIA has been exposed. You can now see exactly what has been going on for years, what we've talked about for years, and it's clear that this is despicable behavior. This was a rogue operation run by a rogue agency.
And yet, no apologies are being issued, and no one is getting punished for what has been done.
In all of our conversations with countries around the world, we'll continue to convey that we ended this practice. It was one of the first steps the president made. We're willing to be open and transparent about our mistakes and make changes, and that's exactly what we did
here. Last one, basically going to say, it's going to be kind of parental. Do as I say, not as I have done or do.
Actually, I think we made the decision to lay out very transparently what exactly we had done in the past that we didn't think was consistent with our values. And I think that's showing strength as a nation, and that's the conversation we'll have with countries around the world.
People will argue that showing strength is not just revealing this, but actually doing something about it.
I have nothing to add to what the Department of Justice has said.
Transparency may be a gross exaggeration by the Obama administration. You see, the redacted 525-page CIA torture report is just a summary, a tiny sliver of the full 6,700-page report being hidden from the public, completely classified, meaning what the world knows about America's past torture practices may be just the tip of the iceberg. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
Manfred Novak is a former UN Special Rapporteur on torture. He told RT's Oksana Boyko that the use of torture in the fight against terrorism is counterproductive.
There are other ways and means how highly sophisticated intelligence organizations can actually deal with terrorism. You should analyze what are the root causes of terrorism. Why are there so many people now going into Syria in order to fight for the Islamic State? Much has to do with the situation in the Middle East, with the Palestinian question, and then not fighting a war against terror. So I think we should stop this military approach to fighting terrorism. Terrorism is one of the worst forms of organized crime, but we should treat it as an organized crime and not as an armed conflict, and apply other techniques in order to reduce the amount of terrorism in the world. I think you see the effects today. I think because of the war on terror, because of Guantanamo Bay, because of the torture, I am afraid that we have today more terrorism rather than less terrorism.
Although U.S. officials have tried to parse the language to protect themselves from the legal and political consequences of their brutal behavior, according to imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, torture by another name is still torture.
Torture by another name. For years after the launch of the Iraq War, the U.S. engaged in and expressly supported torture. Their officers tortured captives in the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, in various secret prisons known as CIA black sites, and it used rendition to send people to places like Egypt or Syria, where experienced torturers awaited them. All of these acts are crimes under international law, such as the CAT, Convention Against Torture, a treaty to which the U.S. is a signatory and thus bound by its terms. But Americans, especially since 9/11, have resorted to some pretty shocking lawyering to try to get away with torture. For one thing, they don't call torture torture. They say enhanced interrogation techniques. Some apologists even minimize torture until it sounds like horseplay, you know, guys being guys. And then you hear about the lawyer-named practice of rectal feeding. I kid you not, rectal feeding. Think of that, and you'll see a kind of madness at work and how power and immunity is addictive. But lawyers can make up new, intriguing terms. The problem is, the CAT Treaty is pretty clear, and physical and mental mistreatment legally constitutes torture. Men chained to the floor, nearly naked, and frozen to death, that's torture. The CIA knows this, as did the highest levels of the U.S. government. That's why they changed the names. And I'll bet you it'll be a cold day in hell before we see former White House personnel tour Europe. They know better. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The former U.S. Army School of the Americas now known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSIC, is a U.S. Department of Defense institute located at Fort Benning near Columbus, Georgia. Since it was formed in 1946, it has provided military training to government personnel of Latin American countries with right-wing governments. In 1961, it was assigned the specific goal of teaching, quote, anti-communist counterinsurgency training, closed quote, a role it fulfilled until the end of the Cold War, when its mission focus was changed to the war on drugs, with narco-guerrillas replacing communists, a term that was later replaced by the generic term terrorists. The Institute trained a number of Latin American dictators and generations of their military and intelligence officials, training which included the use of torture in its curriculum. The name was changed to WINSEC in the year 2000. Although they rarely receive the kind of national and international coverage that's been afforded last week's release of the Senate Intelligence Report, there have been decades of protests at the home of the Institute at Fort Benning. Last month, the protesters, led by longtime anti-torture activist Father Roy Bourgeois, marked the 25th anniversary of the murder of the so-called UCA martyrs, six Jesuit scholars and priests, their housekeeper and her daughter, who were murdered on November 16, 1989, at the campus of Universidad Centroamericana José Simeón Canas, or UCA, in San Salvador, El Salvador, when armed men in uniform burst into their shared residence and gunned down everyone inside.
This is our 25th year that we are putting our feet before this School of Assassins at Fort Benning, Georgia, known as the School of the Americas, also as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. This school is graduates who come from 15 different countries throughout Latin America, have caused untold suffering and death to our sisters and brothers in these countries. And it's all done in our name. It's paid for millions of dollars every year from our tax money. Meanwhile, we're cutting budgets to schools for our children, to the poor, to the elderly, those who lack health care. This is a scandal.
I'm kind of disgusted, honestly, because the fact that our tax dollars and we're paying for this, and the fact that these people killed innocent people, priests, nuns, and it's just, I don't understand how we're so into human rights, yet we're doing a school that is not showing any of it.
My name is Ann Wright. I'm a retired U.S. Army colonel. I'm here with Veterans for Peace at the School of the Americas Watch. I'm very concerned about our military, the military school graduates being a part of killing of their own citizens in their countries when they go back home. So we are here to challenge this military training, and particularly now with the militarization of police departments.
But I definitely had to tell all my teachers before we left that, like, we had to go on, like, I wasn't going to be in school for the next 2 days. And when they asked why I was going down to Georgia, I said that I was going on a protest for SOA. And that when they asked what that was, I just explained it as a school where they take in people from third world countries and train them in democracy, but they're really teaching them how to torture people, and like they send them back down, and they're major contributors in genocides and just awful, awful situations.
What it turns out to be in Latin America is when someone has been murdered, then we call that person's name, and then the group will say presente. No matter if you tried to kill us here, he, she is still here. And so the power of it became here at the School of Assassins, where people have literally, it's not symbolic here. Here, it's, this is where soldiers have been taught to terrorize our own populations. This is where they've been taught to kill. And so we bring the names of those who've been killed by the students of this school and say, presente, they are here, present.
Documents declassified in 2009 by the CIA indicate that the agency knew in advance of the Salvadoran government's plan to murder the six Jesuits. With the protests against police murders of black people in the U.S. growing both in size and intensity, sustained now for more than 5 months since the killing of Eric Garner on July 17th, and exploding with the killing of Michael Brown on August 9th, Many are saying that what began as an apparently spontaneous eruption of discontent has become a movement. Eugene Puryear is a member of the D.C. branch of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and one of the organizers of the Coalition D.C. Ferguson. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Sean Garcia Sunday on the question of whether the protests have reached a point where they can be considered the actions of a movement.
I think we can say that. I think that what we've seen is that really since the murder of Mike Brown, there's been sustained protest. I mean, I think actually in Ferguson, there's been protests every day. And I know in New York, there's been protests close to every day since the non-indictment of the police officers that killed Eric Garner. And also here in Washington, D.C., where I'm based out of, we've seen protests happening almost daily over the past few weeks since the non-indictment of Darren Wilson. And certainly going back to the killing of Michael Brown, a number of demonstrations happening very frequently over the few months. And I think we're seeing all around the country in the Bay Area, not only are there demonstrations happening, but there are organizations starting to be formed, networks starting to be formed and created as well, all of which I think is a sign of the fact that there is indeed a movement. So I believe that this is a movement. I don't know 100% what we can call it, but certainly around this issue of not just police terrorism per se, and I think that's what we have to call it when a black person is being killed every 28 hours in these sorts of situations, but around the general idea that this is representative of the fact that the humanity of black people in America is in so many ways not recognized.
And so what would you say are the dynamics of the movement? Can we compare it to any other historical movements and see it growing into a certain place?
Well, you know, I think all movements in some ways have a certain similarity to the extent that they're, you know, moving for reforms in the American capitalist system and demands are made. I mean, I think the dynamic of this movement, though, that's most notable is that it's so heavily direct action and civil disobedience based. I mean, here in Washington, we have, you know, we only shut down streets now. I mean, those are the only demonstrations that happen at once. Have shut down streets in major commercial areas. We've seen in the Bay Area, there have been people who have shut down the BART train, which is the subway, the metro, the L, the T, whatever city you're in there, the underground train. And these things are happening in really dynamic ways. And I know in New York where, you know, the NYPD really operates sort of a semi-fascist operation in terms of limiting the ability of people to protest with their First Amendment rights. We've seen people take to the streets, block bridges, including the Verrazano Bridge, which if you've ever been over the Verrazano Bridge, the huge major bridge into New York for 7 minutes in recognition of the Eric Garner murder. And so I think that has been tremendous to see New York City, where I would say there are perhaps, having protests in a lot of cities, some of the toughest constraints on protesters, people sort of breaking out and saying, no, we are going to go into the streets. We're going to shut things down. There's not going to be business as usual in terms of economic moves and also the actions of the NYPD. And so I think similar to the civil rights movement, but also to the labor rights movement, where people should remember when they started striking in the 30s, it was illegal to strike. So, you know, ultimately, I think what we're seeing here and what I think shows the dynamism of this movement is the direct action civil disobedience element that isn't limited to just a few people and it's not choreographed, but it's really thousands and thousands of people who are many of them new to activism coming out and, you know, being willing to put their bodies on the line there.
And you've been quoted as saying, you know, we need to not just let this be a moment, but a movement. What do you think are the steps that we need to take to really keep building on what's been going on in the streets?
So I think we have to move from mobilization to organization. We've been bringing a lot of people out, but we have to start to build institutions that can sustain things. And I think that's one piece of it. But more importantly, I think we have to recognize that the police is really a superficial issue in some ways. I mean, the police are, you know, the gatekeepers of a fence that's been put up around black oppressed communities in this country that have been drained of life and vitality. I mean, essentially what you have is a society, a capitalist society that has said to these black poor communities, well, we're not going to give you food, clothing, and shelter, as it were, or really education. And instead of trying to solve the social problems and the ripple effect from these social issues, they have created an entire system of mass incarceration, biased courts, and militarized policing to control those problems.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.